Well, he didn't? Okay. I appreciate Scott teaching for me the last two times. You covered the end of Zechariah's prophecy, which, again, for those who may have forgotten or who are somewhat new to our studies, we included Haggai and Zechariah as just a quick overview of those two prophecies. Thank you. Because they did, God did send them to the remnant, 520 B.C., to encourage them to build the temple. And then we jump back to the record, Ezra chapters 5 and 6, to pick that up. And chapter 6 and verse 15 of Ezra is where we have the record where they completed the temple in the sixth year of Darius. That would be 516 B.C. And they got it done in 4 years after it laid there for 16 years and nothing was happening. So that, again, reinforces or reemphasizes the importance of good teaching, good preaching by these two servants. And they pricked the hearts of the remnant and got them to get back busy to what they needed to do. So, just a real quick review, if you will, to get our minds back to what we're thinking about since we didn't have class on Wednesday because of our singing. Remember the record of the Jews' first return, this would have been, of course, under Zerubbabel, concludes in 516. That's when the temple was completed. That's the end of Ezra chapter 6. Then between Ezra 6 and 7, which I wish we had time to include that in our quarter, but we just don't. There's no way to work in Esther and still get the rest of Ezra and Nehemiah covered. But really, to properly study these books, you need to study all three of them, Ezra, Esther, and Nehemiah. But anyway, between Ezra chapters 6 and 7 is where you plug in the book of Esther. And in chapter 1 of Ezra of Esther and verse 3 tells us that she, or the date given there, was in the reign of Ahasuerus, which was the king, in her story, or Xerxes, back on that chart on page 3 in your folder. We had those lists of Persian kings. Xerxes and Ahasuerus were the same person. That's about 483 B.C. That's why that goes there. And then what we're talking about this morning, Ezra starts the second, or this is the second half of the book of Ezra, chapters 7 through 10, where he brings the second group of remnant now, or the second remnant Jews. And that's about 458 B.C. That's where our story picks up this morning. So, just to, again, set this in our minds, it's been 80 years since Zerubbabel's efforts to bring them back. Not been a little while, it's been 80 long years, all right? It's been 58 years since the temple was built, from 516 to where we are here with 458 B.C. And 25 years, again, if we consider plugging in the story of Esther between Ezra 6 and 7. It's been a quarter of a century since Esther's heroic actions that are recorded in the book that bears her name. Okay, so the emphasis now on Ezra's return will be another building project. Zerubbabel built the temple, and Nehemiah, which will be our next book, he built the walls, but Ezra didn't build anything, a physical structure. But there was a building, if you will. He had to go back, God sent him back, to rebuild the spiritual, what I'm going to call the spiritual infrastructure. He went back to teach, reemphasize again the law. Since it's been this long on some of these, well, my previous chart here, just for a second. Since it's been this many years on some of these activities, this is sort of one of our questions. I think it's question 6, bottom of page 19. How would you have understood the spiritual condition of the remnant? Are they doing well? Not likely. Not likely. And so for Ezra to go back, again, that was the focus. Let's get the law reemphasized again. And it appears that they were guilty of backsliding. Jumping ahead just for the moment, look at chapter 7 of Ezra and verse 25. This, of course, is in the edict, or the decree that Artaxerxes sent that authorized Ezra to lead this second return. The last part of verse 25, what was Ezra told or commanded to do with respect to the remnant? Teach, and how are they described? Those who are ignorant. Now, that's not a slander. That's just saying those who do not know the law, and that seems to indicate there would be some that didn't know the law as well as they should have. I mean, they've had the temple all these years. They've been able to worship all these years. Were there Levites and priests that went back with Zerubbabel? There were. So there should have been some progress, at least not any backsliding, but apparently that's not the case with the remnant. So Ezra's going back to engage in this effort to sort of get them going again. Now, we won't go back and read this, but in Jeremiah 7, in verses 1 through 15, of course, Jeremiah prophesied this before Jerusalem's destruction. He says in that passage, it's about verse 3 or 4, I believe, he says, "Do not trust in deceptive words, saying, 'The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord.'" And that was said because the Jews had convinced themselves, God is not going to send the Chaldeans to destroy us, because what do we have? We have the temple. Now, as far as God was concerned, in their apostate condition, that is, chasing after their idols, as far as God was concerned, what did the temple mean? It meant nothing. And in Ezekiel's prophecy, we have the record where the glory of the Lord departs from the house and goes away, and that's indicating God had pretty much abandoned the facility, and we're going to let things happen, just take the course and be destroyed. So I bring that up because they had a temple. The remnant had this new temple. It was done, it was completed in 516, Darius' sixth year. But that's not enough. They had to be devoted. The remnant needed to be reminded of the importance of faithful devotion to God and His covenant. Do you see any real quick application to us along this same line? We come here to worship. Our building says Church of Christ. But what does that mean? If we're not doing this, what does that mean? It means nothing. We're going to have to be devoted people. We don't want to be ignorant of the law of God. We want to make sure we're understanding the Scripture. Not just that we know it, but that we're really living it. And we're dedicated to the ways of God and to His covenant. So it's real easy to make application. We'll get to verse 10 just in a moment. But verse 10 of Ezra 7 may be one of the best verses in the chapter because it describes Ezra's heart, if you will, and preparation that he made. So, having said all that, now let's get to some of the questions. And let's look at the second return of Ezra. This, again, is in 458 B.C. And Ezra has been decreed by Artaxerxes I to send this remnant back. That's in verse 8. It's in his seventh year. And you go back and look at that table again on page 3. History tells us, secular history tells us, when he began to reign, his seventh year makes it 458 B.C. He started in 465 B.C., I believe, if my numbers are correct. Now, look at question 1, middle part of question 1. And what do we see recorded in the first 5 verses, at least through the last part of verse 1 through verse 5? What's the information given us there? All right, it's the genealogy, it's the ancestral record of Ezra. Why would that be important for us to have that? Why would the Holy Spirit put that in the book, you reckon? Okay, to a Jew, what was important? Your pedigree, your ancestry. But not just to a Jew, but to a priest. Now, I want you to think back for a moment. Remember back in chapter 2? Of Ezra verses 61 through 63, when Zerubbabel led back the first return, there was a problem in those 3 verses. Who couldn't they find? Well, let me take that back. There were some men there who were serving, but what was the problem? They couldn't do something. They couldn't produce the genealogical records. And so they were told, you can't serve anymore at the temple or at the altar until we can verify who you are. So it was important to be able to prove that you were a priest. Of course, you had to be from whose tribe? Not Judah. Levi. And not just that, but from whose family? Because were all Levi's priests? Okay, it'd be from Aaron's family to be a priest. Tribe of Levi, family of Aaron. And if it couldn't be, if that couldn't be validated or verified in some way, then you couldn't serve as priest. So we had, the tribe was always exposed working with the law, copy of the law. What's that tell you about his knowledge of it? I mean, that was his job. He was supposed to know it. As we might say, frontwards and backwards, inside and out. He would know what the law says. So he's a priest. He's a scribe. That's in verse 6. And then verse 10. This is the great verse of Ezra 7. This is why Ezra was so qualified to lead this return. What did Ezra do, first part of verse 7? Verse 10. All right, he prepared or set his heart. So this is something that he wasn't made to do. What if you want to follow God? What are you going to have to do? You're going to have to set your heart to do it. It's not going to happen on accident. It's not going to do that. So he set his heart. He prepared his heart to do what? Notice the order. And it's got to be in this order too. To seek the Lord. To do or practice His will. And then to teach. So can you teach what you don't know? You can't do that. Whether it's math in school, whether it's history, or whether it's the Scripture. You cannot teach what you do not know. And can you practice what you don't know? Well, obviously not. You're going to have to know what it says to do it or to perform it. So here's this good man. Ezra had set his heart to study or to seek the law of the Lord and to do it or practice it and to teach His statutes and ordinances in Israel. So he had the heart of a scribe. And he was the man for the moment to do this job of leading the remnant back on a second return to tackle this deficiency that was there in Judea, in Jerusalem. They weren't knowing, they weren't doing the law. They had backslidden quite a bit. That needed to be addressed, and he was the man to do it. Okay. So, that's the order we're talking about. It's got to be in that order, and we're going to put a star by the last one there. As we're establishing Ezra in these early verses, I'm going to focus on verse 10 mainly, because that's the great verse that describes this good man. Now, to make a quick application of this, and I'm looking at, this is the last part of question 5. I want you to write down some comments or some thoughts about, this verse describes Ezra. It doesn't describe Jeff or Freddie or anybody else. It describes Ezra. But what can we do with this verse? Can we learn anything from this verse? I'm asking the last part of question 5, can this serve as a good model for New Testament Christians today? And if you say yes, which I hope you are saying yes, did you think of any passages that may lead us along the same lines of thinking as Ezra 7 and verse 10 describes Ezra? Did you have any thoughts about that? All right, very good, Bernie. Study to show thyself approved to God, or be diligent as a workman who does not need to be ashamed, but he's able to do what? Rightly divide or handle accurately the word of truth. 1 Timothy 2 and verse 15. All right. In Matthew 12, and I want to look at these real quickly. Matthew chapter 12. So mark your place here in Ezra 7. We won't spend a lot of time on this. In Matthew chapter 12, this passage will emphasize the heart. Remember, in that section, and it's the last part of verse 34 through verse 35. What did Jesus say about the heart? Yes, out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks. Then verse 35, the good man out of his good treasure brings forth what is good, and the evil man out of his evil treasure brings forth what is evil. The determining factor is the heart. Can an evil heart speak good words? No, it's just not possible. There's a disconnect there between the two. We can't fake it. You can fake it to other men, but God certainly would know that you're playing games with it. In John chapter 7, this is one of my favorite passages in John's Gospel. And starting in verse 14, you recall Jesus went up to the synagogue at the feast there, and he was teaching, and they were really amazed that he had this ability. Look at verse 15. Their question was, the Jews, how can this man, or how has this man become learned, having never been educated? And I take that to mean He didn't come to us. You know, they were the seminary, if you will. They were the college. He didn't come learn letters from us, so how did he get to be so smart? Look at Jesus' answer. Verse 16, "My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If any man is willing to do his will." See, that's talking about the heart, about the desire. "If any man is willing to do his will, he shall know of the doctrine." So can you know of the doctrine of the Lord? You can know it if you have the will to know it. If you have the desire to study it and learn it. And I see Ezra in that, back in our chapter. Ezra set his heart to know the law of God and to do it, to practice it. And that then made him able to teach it to others then later. And 2 Timothy 2 and verse 2, Paul says, "The things that you have learned from me, commit them to faithful men who are able to teach others also." But we've got to be faithful. We've got to be the kind of man that Ezra was. So I saw a great lesson to learn here. Even though back in our chapter, this verse does not describe me or you, but it certainly has in it some points that we can chew on for a while and see that we can certainly make ourselves better as he made himself better to serve God. Okay, so one cannot teach what he does not know and does not do himself. And that's just, I know you agree with that. That's not just the case in religion, but in any secular realm of study. You've got to know it to teach it and do it. That's just obvious. All right. Well, let's look at his success, the last part of verse 6 and the verses 8 and 9, and this gets us again to, this is back up in question 4. Artaxerxes had granted his request, and what did Ezra say? That he had been given all that he asked for, because why? Yeah, he credits the good hand of the Lord was on me. Is that how it reads, the last part of verse 6? Because the hand of the Lord, his God, was on him. He gives God credit. He's crediting the providence of God, and he had made requests of the king and had been granted. In the last part of verse 10, I'm sorry, 8 and 9, he came to Jerusalem. How long was the trip to get from Persia to Jerusalem? He left in the He left the first day of the first month and arrived on the first day of the fifth month. That's 4 months, right? 2, 3, 4, 5. 4 months he got there. And who does he credit for the ability to do that? Again, same thing. He credits the hand of the Lord his God. I looked on a map, and if you have a Bible map, if it's detailed enough, it'll show some of the trade routes or the roads that were mainly traveled back in the old empire of the Medes and the Persians. And I just sort of followed that route, if you will, and just did a very crude measuring job. I determined it's roughly around 1,000 miles. Now, if we get in a car today and travel 1,000 miles, I'm not sure where that would take us. It wouldn't be all the way to California, but it'd be somewhere in the middle of the country, I would imagine. Wouldn't take us 4 months, would it? Not hardly. It'd be less than a week, wouldn't it? I think we could travel that in less than a week. But they didn't have anything like that back then. They had very crude methods of travel. So to travel 1,000 miles in 4 months, there's going to be adversity out there. Opposition is going to be hardship of some type. Animals may die on the way. I mean, we're going to have to scrounge around for food, take all these provisions. It's a great undertaking. And again, Ezra gives God the credit for the ability to make this journey. Now, that may not be the exact distance, but for our purposes, that'll serve good enough to illustrate how much he gives God credit for this journey. All right. This is question 6 now. Look at verses 11 through 26. This is the bulk of the chapter. You can read the decree of Artaxerxes. Cyrus gave the decree for Zerubbabel, and we talked about that some. Well, Artaxerxes has given a decree or an edict for Ezra to return. And as you read that, there's some things that we want to highlight, if you will. There had been much time that had passed since return number one. We sort of discussed that already in our class. Can't prove this, but most commentators agree that more than likely by this time, Joshua and Zerubbabel are both dead. There's no fact of that in the Scripture, but that would be more likely the case. Again, because we said it had been How long since they'd been back? The first remnant? 80 years. And however old Zerubbabel was when he led them, you tack on 80 more years of that, and it's more than likely he would be dead. We don't have any age about the two of them, but we'll just state that like it is. So, again, verse 25, Ezra having to teach the ignorant Jews is indicative, at least to me, that they had been backsliding again, spiritually speaking. They were not as diligent in the law as they should be in practicing the commandments of the first covenant. So, verse 13, and this is top of page 20. Gave you three or four, five blanks there to write down just some of the things that you saw in the decree. What does verse 13 contain with Artaxerxes' words? What does it authorize? Okay, it authorizes Ezra to lead it, and whoever wants to join him, you can follow him if you please. You can go with him just like it was authorized with Zerubbabel. Those who want to follow him, you go ahead and go back. So this was the royal permission, if you will, to lead this group back. All right, what about verses 15 through 18? What did the decree cover? Yeah, money, supplies, financial provisions, and an authorization for the purchasing of sacrificial animals are in the decree. So when they get back, Ezra's going to lead them in worship. Well, to worship under that first covenant, what are you going to have? Make sacrifice. You're going to have some animals. And so they were given money from the treasury, supplies, or other ways to support this trip, if you will, and that edict at that juncture covers that. Also looked at verses 21 through 24. What did the king decree from the surrounding peoples once they got there? Yeah, you've got to support them. So, I mean, Ezra, how much backing does he have from the crown? He's got it. I mean, he's got the authority to do whatever it is that he needs. Now, I don't think Ezra was going to take advantage of this. I'm just saying he got all that he asked for. He credits God for that. And Artaxerxes is giving him whatever he wanted to perform his task, his functions, to lead them into proper behavior as the people of God. So verses 21 through 24 cover other financial aspects. In fact, in verse, point this out right quick, if I can find it. Yeah, verse 24. What did the decree prohibit or say was not allowed? Yeah, you can't tax the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, all those who would be serving at the temple. They are free from taxation. So the king saw fit to put that in the decree. Going to make it somewhat easier on them to perform their tasks. That's in verse 24. All right. Verse 25, the first part of verse 25, this is the fourth blank, if you will. What is it that the Artaxerxes also ordered Ezra to do once he got back? This is not as spiritual. This is somewhat more civil. Yeah, set up some sort of form of rule, magistrates, officials, some sort of government, you know, have it set up there. Again, that might indicate, again, because Zerubbabel, when he went back, he served as the governor. Well, if he's dead, maybe there's a lack of civil rule there. Maybe that's lacking in some places. We don't know. But him being told here in the decree, you set this up, that would seem to indicate to sort of shore up those areas that had some deficiency in it. The last part of verse 25, we've mentioned this before, Ezra was told to teach the law to those who are ignorant. So, yes, you're going back to do these other things, but your primary purpose, Ezra, is to teach. Get the Jews back again, sort of in touch, in harmony with God, observing His law, doing His will, all those kinds of things. And then verse 26, how's the decree end? So this is sort of just a general statement. And this isn't a threat. But the kings can say this kind of language. What was the point of verse 26?
That's right. Now, if you don't follow this decree, this comes from the crown, you don't do this, there's going to be a penalty to pay. What was the penalty? It could be, that's right, could be banishment, or well, death, or for banishment, or for confiscation. We might come and take some of your stuff away. So any form of punishment deemed appropriate by, could be Ezra that would make that decision, it could be the officials he sets up, the magistrates, or it could come from the crown. The news gets back to Artaxerxes, hey, so-and-so group, they didn't cooperate with this. There's going to be that would have to be dealt with, and so all that was covered in the decree. So again, if you're Ezra and you see the contents of this decree, how are you feeling about things? Feel pretty good? Yeah, feel pretty good. I've got the king on my side. He's fully supportive of this. I'm going to be able to get a lot of things accomplished that are lacking and are wanting there in Judea. Yeah, Rob. Yes, very good point. Rob is saying, as you look at the way the magistrates are described in verse 25, appoint magistrates and judges that they may judge all the people who are in the province beyond the river, even all those who know the laws of your God, and you may teach anyone who's in the... So everyone was to be in tune with what the primary focus was, that is to serve God, to be obedient to Him under the terms of the law of Moses. That's a good observation to make. Okay. Well, again, the decree clearly shows Ezra had the authority of the king behind him. And then look in verse 23. I think there's something that the king feared himself. Why was he being so supportive of Ezra? He had a personal fear. Now, he's not in covenant with Jehovah. He's a pagan. But Scott, what was he afraid of in verse 23? Yeah, I don't want to incur the wrath of Ezra's God. So... I'm really behind this. Now, he most likely all the kings of that day, they were polytheists, so he probably worshipped all the gods, but he feared Ezra's God to the extent that he put this in the decree, and we don't want anything coming back on us from Ezra's God, so we're going to placate this, we're going to support this to the end, and we want Ezra to succeed in this matter. You see that there again in verse 23. Okay, well, I asked in question 8, this is a thought question, and this came to my mind, and I thought it was good for us to think about. Remember back in chapter 4 of Ezra, when the record was given, when they started to build the temple, and it got stopped, chapter 4 and verse 24 tells us it was stopped until Darius' second year, which we've covered all that already. But the bulk of chapter 4 contained a letter that the opponents of the first group under Zerubbabel had written to, which king was it? It was Artaxerxes. And the complaint was, as you remember what the letter said, that if you let this happen, they're going to rebel. They have a history of rebellion. They've risen up in rebellion in the past. City's been destroyed because of that, and that was sort of their past. And so if you allow this, you're just asking for trouble. And that was the letter. And remember how Artaxerxes responded? Did he agree with the letter, or did he agree with the remnant? He agreed with the letter. And he said, that's right, stop the rebuilding of the city until you hear back from me. Well, how do we harmonize that with this decree to Ezra? It's the same king. You think about that, son? How do we put these two together? Okay. He was informed of the decree of Cyrus, is what you're referring to. The way I thought about this, most likely the decree to Ezra would have been after what's in Ezra 4. I can't prove that, but it seems to make more sense I can't see Ezra being approved for all this by the king in Ezra 7, and then this thing in Ezra 4 is after that. That doesn't make any sense. I think what most likely had happened was this. Yes, Artaxerxes did agree to stop the rebuilding efforts of the remnant in Judea. And that's clear because that's what his letter says in chapter 4. But Ezra comes along, and it's obvious that Ezra gained his favor, gained his trust. I know that's so because how was he treated in this decree in chapter 7? Very well. Very well. So obviously, maybe what Rick is saying is correct. Maybe he realized the other half of the story and that helped him change his mind. Now that he does offer the remnant what they need to return under Ezra. But it seems to me that it would be best to understand that what's found in chapter 4 happened before what is recorded here in chapter 7. A change of heart of the Persian king there. Okay. Chapter 7 concludes. This is question number 9. How does Ezra praise the king? Well, he doesn't necessarily praise the king. Who does he really praise? He praises the Lord. That's right, Bobby. Read, if you read for us, Bobby, the last two verses of Ezra 7, verses 28 and 29, please. So he says, blessed be the God, blessed be the Lord that has done all this. Again, it's not really praise for Artaxerxes, it's praise for the King of Heaven. He takes no credit for himself, does he? He doesn't say, you know, I worked all this out and it's really all due to me. He doesn't say that. Not at all. He credits God for causing this situation. He thanks God for the king's goodness. I'm thankful to my God that this king has been so good and he's allowed this to happen. That shows appreciation on the part of Ezra. And then strengthen, he says, this strengthened me. The last part of verse 28, what does he do to sort of help this situation truly get off the ground? Yeah, he collects others to go with him. And it wasn't just normal antibodies, it was leading men. It was those who would have some standing or some clout, if you will, among the Jews there in Susa, in the Persian capital, gathered leading men from Israel to go up with him. So he's strengthened, he's got this decree in his hand and he's ready to go to get back to lead the remnant in this second return. Now, we get to chapter 8, the first 14 verses. It's a list of names. I'm not demeaning it by saying that way. But as you look at this, I ask the question. This is question 10. How many men are numbered? Did you do some math? Do some counting. The number, including Ezra, is of 1,515. If you count all that up, I did it twice. I think that's right, but I'm maybe off one or two. But anyway, what I did ask is how. What would you guess the total to be if you include women and children? Do we know that there's children? Yeah, how do we know that? There's a verse in the chapter. Look at chapter 8 and verse 21. When Ezra's praying later on, who does he mention? Little ones. There are little ones there. So to assume that these men were all single, not married, is a great assumption. But he mentions later in a prayer, when they're camped, ready to complete the journey, and as far as God protecting the group, he mentions our little ones. So these were families that went. This wasn't just men. So to do some extrapolation here, it may have well totaled 6,000-7,000, maybe even a little more than that, this contingent that Ezra's leading. Now how did this compare with the first remnant? That's a lot less. That's right. Maybe it's about a seventh the size, one-eighth the size. Of course, we know how many were in the first one because the Scripture tells us, but this one we're just guessing if these men had families. So if that guess is somewhat approximately close, then it was significantly smaller than the first group that went back. But he is leading a group of Jews back nonetheless to Jerusalem. All right. The journey, verses 15 through 32, this covers the next few questions. If we continue on here, they camped at the river that leads to Ahava, you'll see listed there. And they stayed there 3 days. What did they discover? There's no Levites among us. So what did Ezra do to fix that problem? He sent a contingent. This gets us to verse 16 and 17. How many came? Some more math here. I counted above 260 men came. Again, why do you have to have Levites? The work, they had work to do at the temple. Again, these could have been Levites as well as priests, because as we said before, all priests are Levites, not all Levites are priests, and so whatever the makeup was, or there were duties to perform, and they didn't have any Levites. And so they sent, and some men were sent to them. Again, look at verses 18 through 20. We keep seeing this about Ezra's character. Verse 18, according to the good hand of our God upon us, they brought us a man of insight of the sons of Malai, the son of Levi, the son of Israel, Sherebiah, and his sons, his brothers, 18 men, Hashabiah and Jesaiah, the sons of Merari, with his brothers and their sons, 20 men, and 220 are listed there, servants of the temple, in verse 20. So, again, he credits Jehovah for this this infusion of Levites who would be needed to perform this work at the temple. Now, they proclaimed a fast, and they sought God's protection for the journey, 21 through 23. And there's something else that Ezra mentions that he had not done previously when he was dealing with the king. Obviously, the king offered something to Ezra. What had he offered him? Yeah, military escort. We'll send horsemen with you. We'll send soldiers. I don't want anything to happen to you as you go back to this journey. And what did Ezra said, obviously? No thanks. Don't think I want that. And he gave the reason why. What did he told the king? We don't need your horsemen because we've got God. He's going to protect us. And Ezra said, I was sort of ashamed. Like my version says, verse 22, I was ashamed to request from the king troops and horsemen because we had said already, we have Jehovah. He's going to... So to kind of go back on my word about that would have made me look really bad. And I didn't want to make my faith or my God look weak and you know, pitiful. So he had said, we don't need the protection as we left Susa. He had refused the escort. So what did they do? They had put themselves completely in God's hands, totally willing to do that. That says what about their faith? Strong faith. They're making this journey across unknown territories, if you will. Had no idea the danger that was out there. I tell you, that's faith speaking. That's faith in action. And we need to be really impressed by that. So he divides the temple wealth between the Levites. All that money he had received, the gold, the silver, the utensils, they were to carry it. They'd be responsible for bringing it all safely to Jerusalem and then to deliver it to the priest at the temple. We see that there in the text. And then one final thing here. God vindicates Ezra. How'd they make the trip? Did they arrive okay? They did. And that's what God had promised. Ezra had his faith in him, and that's what Jehovah gave them. So he brought them safely to Jerusalem, and he was always over them, the text says. He was with them, delivering them from the troubles on the way. Earlier verses we looked at where it said that I'll be with you if you do this. And again, that's the Jehovah of this story. Finally, they get to Jerusalem. They rest for 3 days. What's Ezra do with all that wealth? He hands it over to the temple servants there. They offered sacrifices. And chapter 8 concludes, what do you do with the decree? All the governing authorities in the surrounding area said, all right, this is from the king. And that's how things are going to be now. And so they fully understood then that that was royal authority, if you will, from the crown. Okay. We sort of hurried up quickly, but I didn't want to leave anything chapter 8 unfinished. So, the Lord willing, Wednesday night we'll do lesson 9. And again, if you did not get lessons 10 and 11, you'll need that before you leave today. Be back here in the back of the auditorium. Thank you very much for your attention.